WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and suddenly Russia is front and center in our national politics. Trump's admiration for Vladimir Putin was always controversial in the campaign. So is his contention that Russia could be an ally rather than an enemy in Syria. It was widely believed that the hacks of Democratic Party emails were staged by Russia and distributed by them through WikiLeaks. Now we have the main concern about Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson being that his company, ExxonMobil, stands to profit, big league, if the U.S. lifts economic sanctions on Russia. And the big front page article in the Times today, called Hacking the Democrats, just about admits that the Times, among many others, failed to take the apparent Russian interference in our election seriously enough while the campaign was still going on. In all these instances, Putin and Russia are seen as enemies and thugs. But my next guest has a different view. Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus of Russian history at Princeton, is a contributor to The Nation, which is obviously no fan of Donald Trump. And yet, throughout the campaign and still now, Cohen has asserted that Trump has been largely right about Russia, while the media and his fellow progressives refuse to see it. Let's hear more. Thanks for coming on, Stephen Cohen. Welcome back to WNYC.
We haven't talked in a long time, and I'm very pleased to be with you.
We'll get to some of the specifics, like Russia influencing the election and Rex Tillerson's conflict of interest there. But first, would you give everyone a sense of your basic premise of what you call false narratives of a new Cold War?
All right, let me try to summarize it, because I think you're right. You need to know what I think more generally. We are in a new Cold War, by whatever name, with Russia. This Cold War is so dangerous that three new Cold War fronts are fraught with the possibility of hot war between the two nuclear superpowers. That would be the Baltic region, where NATO is doing a very reckless and major military buildup, Ukraine, which is the political epicenter of the new Cold War, and, of course, Syria. This is more dangerous Cold War for several reasons. One, obviously, if your listeners are somewhere not as old as I am, but in that neighborhood, they remember that the last epicenter of Cold War was in Berlin, far from Russia. So one Cold War front, and now two, the Baltics and Ukraine, are right on Russia's border. In addition, there are no rules of this new Cold War. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, American presidents and Soviet leaders worked out a kind of code of conduct so we wouldn't get near the nuclear tripwire. But there's an additional reason, and it alarms me greatly, that we have developed fallen back on the neo-McCarthyite habit of slurring people who don't agree with the orthodox consensus that Russia is solely to blame for the new Cold War. It began with little people like me back in 2014, 2015. They began calling people such as myself Putinologists and Putin's clients and Kremlin's useful idiots. Then they got around to Donald Trump because he had said, I think we should cooperate with Russia. Now we have this hacking story for which there are, as yet, no public facts. And what's happened is the whole discourse about Russia in Washington has turned into a kind of hysteria when we need, urgently, a calm debate about American policy toward Russia, probably since the end of the Soviet Union, which, Brian, by the way, is marked by its 25th anniversary this month, but certainly in the last 4 or 5 years. So I'm deeply alarmed by this combination of circumstances, and I would say that The danger in our relationship with Russia is as great as it was during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, and possibly growing even more dangerous.
And listeners, our phones...
And that's the good news, by the way.
We'll get to the bad news, I guess. And we'll get phone calls for Stephen Cohen if you want to talk to him. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And there's so much in there that I want to follow up on, like when you say there's no public facts regarding the hacking of the DNC emails. But just to this last point you made about the danger rivaling the Cuban Missile Crisis, I mean, at that point, we were on the brink of nuclear war, so it seemed, and now there's, you know, there are these flashpoints, the ones you mentioned, but nobody's threatening anybody with nuclear weapons, not the U.S. or Russia against each other, right?
It's not entirely true. Nobody actually threatened the use of nuclear weapons during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's just that the Kennedy administration perceived that putting Soviet missiles in Cuba was a nuclear threat, and they were right, of course. The difference was is we had two rational actors negotiating at the top, Kennedy and Khrushchev, men of World War II, I would say, men who knew what war meant, understood what was at stake. I'm not sure we have those rational actors in Washington today. Secondly, at that moment, we were dealing with one crisis, Cuba. As I said before, we're dealing with the crisis in the Baltics in Ukraine, and as you well know, I think you had someone on about this today, Syria, mm-hmm. where things are, in terms of the conflict between the United States and Russia, just getting worse and worse.
But you see Trump, in general, as trying to prevent a new Cold War, and liberals, ironically, like the Clinton campaign, President Obama, and media like the New York Times and MSNBC, you mentioned all of those in one of your articles, of trying to stoke a new Cold War. Why would liberals do that?
Well, you'll have to tell me. I mean, my wife, who's the editor of The Nation magazine, I ask her that every day.
That's Katrina Vandenhoevel, for people who didn't know that Stephen Cohen and Katrina Vandenhoevel are married. Do you agree on Russia, by the way, the two of you?
Well, now you're probing into a marriage of 30 years. We agree on many fundamental issues. She disagrees with me, I think, on my indictment of American liberals and progressives who have indulged not only in this unwise Putin demonizing, but in slurring people here who disagree. But, you know, what my wife and I disagree about isn't public policy, and we try to keep it under wraps. The real point is that, and again, it's a question of age. I always got to be careful that people remember. We had a major debate in this country in the 70s and 80s, and it featured people who wanted more Cold War, more military buildup in this country, and a group of us, a pretty large group, we were arguing for what was then called détente. And it was a fair playing field. We all got published in the New York Times and the Washington Post. There wasn't the internet then, but we got on the radio shows and we got on TV. So we couldn't say we were shut out. We're shut out now. There hasn't been an op-ed on the New York Times or Washington Post editorial pages, op-ed pages, arguing that the United States is at least equally to blame for this new Cold War crisis. They simply will not accept those articles. Nor has there been anyone of that kind on MSNBC. So this is the problem. In a democracy, you fight through discourse. If you can't get to the mainstream media and make the argument, in debate form if they prefer, then there's no way of slowing the drift toward catastrophe. And what alarms me about this whole Trump thing, and let me issue the equivalent of the old Cold War, I am not now, nor have I ever been, a Trump supporter. I am not. What I did say during the campaign is that of all the presidential candidates during the primaries and then during the general election, only Donald Trump did two wise and positive things. And, of course, he campaigned in bumper stickers, so you can never be sure fully what he thought. The first thing is he refused to demonize Putin, which has become the currency of the debate here. Now just look at what McCain says about him, and that's typical of the Senate. Secondly, he made this statement. Wouldn't it be great to cooperate with Russia instead of fight with it? And the answer to that question is it would be better to great. It would be profoundly in our national security. So that's the extent of my enthusiasm for Donald Trump.
But you think he's right on that point. I
think he's more than right. He's become, for those of us who want detente, and I'm not alone, I could rattle off very familiar names to you. We have a group called the American Committee for East-West Accord, and on our board are very eminent people, including Ronald Reagan's former ambassador to Moscow, Jack Matlock, you know, a very eminent former ambassador and historian. Point is, we can't get the word out there. And when they slur Trump as a Kremlin agent or a Kremlin client, as the New York Times and Paul Krugman did yesterday, that stigmatizes all of us. And I will tell you in all honesty, younger people, much younger than myself, young professors, graduate students, even some journalists have told me they worry about speaking out because of their careers. And that's McCarthyism. We know what it did to us once before.
You have even written that the recent concern about Russia-generated fake news is a new McCarthyism. Now, to most of my listeners, that's going to sound bizarre on first blush. Concern about fake news is McCarthyism?
I'm not sure I did write that or intend to say that. I don't know that it's McCarthyism. Let me put it differently. And I'm not sure what this new mantra of fake news is. But if you were to ask me who generates more misleading information, the aggregate of the American mainstream media plus our government-funded broadcasting services, you know, Voice of America, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, or the Russians, and we measure this in terms of their budgets and their impact on America, let's leave Europe aside, I would say we make the Russians look very feeble indeed. Because if the New York Times prints stories that are not factually correct, that are not historically verifiable, and does this regularly, and this is repeated on all the major networks, and in the Washington Post, and in lesser newspapers, this is, I wouldn't call it fake news, I wouldn't call it disinformation, but it is not accurate information. And there's no pushback is the problem. The way you sort this out, I think, Brian, you know, this is your profession, not mine. But in the broadcast media, for example, you try to get an approximation of accuracy and truth by allowing conflicting points of view to conflict publicly. I mean, that's the premise of democratic discourse. All we have now is one hand clapping.
My guest is Princeton and NYU Professor Emeritus of Russian History and Russian Studies, Stephen Cohen, also a contributing editor at The Nation magazine. We have a board full of calls, but I want to get one more thing, and that is, since you're on The New York Times, and I'm sure they would dispute the characterization in your last answer and say there are other points of view, certainly including Donald Trump's point of view about Russia, which is similar to yours in this respect, that do get on their pages. But did you read the dominant front page story in the Times today called Hacking the Democrats, How Russia Honed Its Cyber Power and Trained It on an American Election?
I did.
And do you dispute that Russia did hone its cyber power and train it on an American election?
All right. So you're now asking a question about fact. I'm not an intelligence in the, you know, information gathering, espionage, cyber sense expert. But here is the reality of it based on what the Times and the Post have published, because they basically start breaking the story. Well, this actually goes back, and this is important, Brian, goes back to about August during the general election when the Clinton campaign decided to run not against Trump and Pence, but against Trump and Putin. They literally start driving this out in their emails daily, their campaign material. This was a form of Kremlin baiting, or what we used to call red baiting. Since Putin's not a communist, you can't red bait him. And the Times carried this on the front page in all seriousness. There were headlines, Trump, Putin, this and that. So it began during the campaign. By the way, it did Mrs. Clinton no good, which is the good news. The American voters are not interested in Kremlin baiting, it turns out. The question of what facts we have for hacking, we will not know until they're actually presented. So far, including in this endlessly long, it must be 15,000 words in the Times today, no actual facts are presented. And you know that the FBI, which by profession has to produce evidence that's court-worthy because they prepare cases to be prosecuted in a courtroom. The FBI is not going along. They're hemming and hawing, and there's a lot of anger at the FBI.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the only thing the FBI, the main thing the FBI is not going along with, that Russia did this purposely to help Trump get elected, but they do agree with the CIA, as reported, that Russia did do it, direct the hacking of the DNC emails and share them with WikiLeaks?
I think that's a kind of evolving question. It seems clear that when the issue first came up, they were highly dubious and said that they couldn't confirm what the CIA was reporting. And this led to a lot of anger against the FBI when they briefed senators. Then most of the attention focused on Comey and that he had somehow not behaved properly. Even the CIA, by the way, in the reports that have been published, say it's unable to link the hacking to the Kremlin. All it's certain about is someone in Russia did the hacking. What does that mean? Well, it means that for various reasons that won't interest you, Russia has an enormous number of highly skilled computer digital hacking experts, a lot of freelancers. They sell their services on the open market. So it's possible that if in fact, the Democratic National Committee was hacked, it might have come from somewhere in Russia. But that doesn't mean it came from Putin. They can't nail that yet. And now, we're supposed to have an investigation, correct, Brian? Everybody's going to call in for an investigation.
Right. It looks like Congress is going to do something.
Yeah, they're going to do something. But here's the problem. I'm not sure we're going to learn anything from it. Because to judge, whether you judge, I judge, or listener judge, we have to be shown the facts they have. For example, they have an informer in Putin's inner circle who says he ordered this. Or they've tapped the phones, as Snowden says the NSA can tap everybody's phone. Or they have satellite intercepts, that they've got real intelligence facts. The problem is they will say they can't present them because it'll divulge how we go about this kind of surveillance. So if they do it, it'll be held in a highly classified setting, and then we'll be forced to rely again on second and third hand accounts of what was reported. There's something else. I don't want to filibuster you, but there's a group called, I don't know if you've heard of them, Veteran Intelligence Officers for Sanity.
No.
You have. Well, they've been around for a few years. It's a fairly large group of former CIA, NSA intelligence officials who retired and have formed a group to monitor the information that our intelligence agencies put out. Today or yesterday, they issued a report. It was published on Robert Perry's consortiumnews.com. And they think it wasn't hacking at all, but it was leaking. And they present their professional intelligence reasons for thinking it wasn't a hack job, it was a leak job. Now, if it was a leak job, if they're right...
You mean a leak by somebody inside the DNC?
Well, good. I mean, it means it was an American. Now, was it in the DNC? Not necessarily. Could have been some other American who was leaking, who had seen things, and who dumped the material. But if they are right, or even raise a fundamental question, we're having the wrong discussion. There are two, look.
But not much evidence for that, according to the 17 intelligence services, right?
Well, wait a minute. Let's stop and add. They always say 17 intelligence services. Neither you nor I can name these 17, right? We didn't even know we had 17. But the format is this: for an official national intelligence estimate. That's the highest category of intelligence estimate that's presented to the United States president, if he actually sees it, but it's prepared for him. Allegedly, there are 17 agencies. They admit they haven't done that estimate. These are just assessments. Now, you think, well, Cohen's being Talmudic, but they're the ones that are being Talmudic. Until they do an actual estimate, which would take months, until they do it, you can't talk about any kind of consensus in our intelligence agencies.
But,
so what they're talking about are assessments, opinions, and they're not telling us what facts they base that on. And meanwhile, we're polluting our discourse about Russia during an exceedingly dangerous time in our relations with Russia. This is really the bad news.
Let me get a couple of phone calls on for you, and here's one who is not buying it. Boris in Flatbush, Ukrainian American. Boris, you're on WNYC with Stephen Cohen. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Brian? Okay. Great to be on the show. I just want to say I've listened to Professor Cohen over the years on the John Batchelor show, and he routinely ignores or downplays any facts that point to Russia as a villain on the world stage. He freely promotes pro-Russian conspiracy theories as facts, and his goal is to push for more and more Russian propaganda in our discourse. And he should not be treated as an impartial specialist on Russia, but rather as a debater whose duty it is to defend Putin in every single situation. I'd like to challenge Professor Cohen to defend Donald Trump's assertion that the intelligence community is wrong about Russian meddling in our election, which seems to be clear for anyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, you were just addressing that. Do you want to put any other refutation of that on the table briefly?
Well, I'm not the only one who's – I'm not following Trump here. There are other serious people who are asking on what facts these intelligence reports are based. I just cited this group of former intelligence officers. These are very serious people. These are men and women who came to retirement age and felt it their duty to monitor the intelligence services. So I'm not alone in this. To say that I believe in conspiracy theories, I don't. And I don't know why one would say that what Putin, for example, says about international affairs is a conspiracy theory. It's not a conspiracy theory, for example, to say that we expanded NATO's power to Russia's western borders, and that was bound to lead to trouble. That's not conspiracy theory. That's human intelligence. And when it began in the 1990s, George Kennan, who was then regarded as our greatest thinker, diplomatic and historical, about Russia, protested and said it will lead to a new Cold War and a more dangerous one. And George was right. So this is critical thinking, and we need space for critical thinking. And it's not pro-Kremlin, it's pro-American national security, and it's not conspiracy thinking. It's trying to get the facts out. Let the intelligence agencies, it actually comes down to Obama, Brian. If Obama is willing to declassify information in order to present the facts, then you and I can have this discussion once we read these actual facts. But none have been presented thus far.
Lucy in Midtown, you're on WNYC with Stephen Cohen. Hi.
Brian, I love your show.
Thank you.
This is so exciting. I have a question for your guest about what his thoughts are on the Trump picks for cabinet members, because it seems like there's sort of some are a little more pro-Russia and some are very not pro-Russia. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And she mentioned to our screener Tillerson and Mattis in particular. So on Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, if I can get that question honed to more specifics, when his company reportedly stands to make $500 million if the economic sanctions on Russia are lifted, is that a conflict of interest that concerns you?
Did you say $500 million?
That's what I read.
No, more like $200 billion.
Okay.
I mean, ExxonMobil is in Russia very, very big time. Russia has, if not the most, near the most, unexplored oil reserves. But they're under Arctic waters. They're devilishly hard to extract. Russia doesn't have the money or the infrastructure or the technology, so they signed a deal with ExxonMobil when Tillerson was head of it, and he still is CEO, and that was frozen by the sanctions. The way you talk about this is you drop the pro and anti-Russian labels. You just drop them. Somebody who disagrees isn't pro-Russian, and somebody who takes a harder line isn't anti-Russian. We all think we're speaking on behalf of American national security. Tillerson is an interesting case. By all accounts, I don't know him, he's an enormously able man who's run one of the biggest corporations in the world, and very successfully. So if you believe in global capitalism, I'm not a fan of it, Tillerson is an obvious candidate. Moreover, ExxonMobil is so big and so far-flung, it has its own intelligence services, its own State Department. And Tillerson has traveled the world doing deals, making profits for ExxonMobil. If he didn't do that, his directors and his shareholders would have fired him. So he is one of the most successful corporate CEOs in America, maybe in the world. And it's in that sense that he had a relationship with the Kremlin, because Putin has to sign off personally on mineral deals, subsoil and oil and natural gas. The Kremlin signs off on these deals. So Tillerson courted Putin, as any American CEO would. By the way, every American oil company went chasing Russian oil. So did British BP, British Petroleum. So did other oil companies in the world. Others are drilling there. Others are profiting there. So Tillerson did what he was supposed to do by the rules of our capitalist system. My concern about Tillerson is, do we really want an oil guy running American foreign policy? Whether he's pro-Russian or anti-Russian, do we want somebody whose entire life has been maximizing the profits of the oil industry? Now, he's said to be able. He's said to be smart. I assume he's a great patriot. He'll make the necessary adjustments in his priorities. But he wouldn't have been my choice. But on the list that Trump was putting out there, he's probably one of the two best choices Trump could have made. Mm. And that's all we can say. But how does it promote a serious discussion of our foreign policy to start slurring him as a friend of Putin? What does that mean? He and Putin go to clubs at night together? That Putin has him over for dinner? That he knows Putin's daughters? That he's played with Putin's dogs? You know, Putin's a big dog.
Well, that he has a potential, and we're going to run out of time in a minute, but that he has a potential conflict of interest.
That's correct. And that has to be explored. But look, we've had other secretaries of state who have had we've had other presidents who had potential conflicts of interest. That's the job of the voters and the Senate to explore, but not the loose allegations that somehow he's pro-profit, not pro-Putin.
And on that, you and all our listeners probably agree. And we could keep drilling down on this topic, but we are out of time. Thank you very much. Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian History at Princeton and NYU, and a contributing editor at The Nation magazine. Thank you.
My thanks to you.